This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I do think he did something that was really inappropriate, however he intended it. Still, I think that this highlights this sort of gray area that these scientists are navigating, and I think that there should be clearer rules and more disclosure and more transparency.
Now that Stephen Colbert has put his alter ego to bed, some of you may be missing broadcasters pretending to be someone else. Well, apparently Colbert is not the only imitator out there. University of Florida horticultural science professor Kevin Folta invented a persona for his podcast, The Science Power Hour, with your host Vern Blazek. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Brooke Burrell, a BuzzFeed journalist who recently wrote about how, in interviewing himself, Blazek, or Folta, criticized anti-GMO activists and stirred up some controversy. Burrell and I talk about the fake podcast persona, about how the Folta-Blazek position on GMOs has erupted into a firestorm, and how one unassuming podcast has raised much larger issues around the need for transparency when big business and academic science commingle. He tells us about a process which mimics lobster shell generation, transforming carbon dioxide to a calcium carbonate base that can be used as cement or concrete. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise. As far as you know. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by science writer, journalist, Brooke Burrell. Brooke, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you've done a lot of work in the past on genetically modified organisms, GMOs. The latest twist in your work is pretty fascinating. Why don't you give us a background on how you came across Kevin Folta and tell us a little bit more of his story.
Well, Kevin Folta is a scientist at the University of Florida. He's the chair of the horticulture department there, if I remember correctly. And he's been, the first time I ever heard his name, prior to this piece I just published, I hadn't actually used him as a source before, but he's quoted in a lot of news outlets on GMOs. He's been very active speaking about the science of GMOs, talking about, from, I guess, a pro-GMO perspective. And I met him in person for the first time at a conference I attended in California at UC Davis in June. But this particular story, and at that time, I should back up, at that time, he and several other scientists, at this point it's more than 40, had these Freedom of Information requests, levied at them, this group called US Right to Know was looking to look at their emails to see if they have any ties to big industry, big companies like Monsanto and others. Monsanto's the one that everyone generally really gets riled up about. So when I met him at that conference, this was a topic of conversation amongst all of the scientists. And maybe a month and a half after I left the conference, he contacted me to see if I would be on a podcast that he has. And at the time I was doing book promotion. I had a book not on GMOs, on bed bugs, actually, that came out earlier this year. And I was doing a ton of interviews for that. And I said, sure. And then he started explaining the podcast. And it turned out that it was something he was doing under a pseudonym. And I had been contacted by this pseudonym that he was using. I didn't realize it was a pseudonym at the time on Twitter earlier in the summer. And I was really confused because I had noticed on the website that he had been a guest on the show as well. And so we had this very interesting exchange on email. I was really confused as to why he was doing this podcast under a pseudonym and interviewing himself. And I wanted to understand what exactly that was. I wasn't comfortable being on the podcast anymore. And that's what started part of this story. Then later his emails started coming out because of this FOIA request, and we can talk a little bit more about that later, but that's when I decided to write the story.
So tell us the intersection between the Vern Blazek Science Power Hour and Kevin Folta.
Well, the podcast, when I first noticed it and when I was first emailing with him about it, It just looked like a straight science communication podcast. In our email exchange, he said it was intended as maybe a parody or a satire. The parody part came from, he was imitating this host called Art Bell, who used to have a radio show that I guess covered supernatural phenomena and stuff like this. And this was supposed to be an answer to that, but with more of a science twist. But it wasn't clear at the time on any of the interviews or also on the website that this was intended as a parody, and it really didn't come across as parody or satire, which is why we were going back and forth and I was trying to understand what exactly it was. He did compare it to Colbert at the time. He's also compared it to other radio shows like Rush Limbaugh, other people that maybe host under pseudonyms. I don't know what his intent was. He says it was satire or parody, but there were some folks that went on the show that weren't told that it was a pseudonym, that were just told it was, and weren't told it was a parody or a satire. And some of them were even people that he knew through work. And I also know that some people that were on the show that did know it was a parody, or did know that it was him, were not under the impression that it was a parody or a satire. So it seemed a little muddled as to what was going on.
So, Brooke, what exactly was Kevin Fault saying in these podcasts that caught your attention?
He was interviewing himself about whether or not he had ties to Monsanto, and he answered that he didn't have direct ties. They don't fund his research, but that sometimes they might fund some conferences and stuff like that for students.
And he was talking about GMOs in the same breath as well, if I'm not mistaken.
He was talking about GMOs. He was talking about the science of GMOs and some of the misconceptions about the science.
And to clarify, this is not like a huge podcast or anything. This is almost like a hobby, right?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, this was something that seemed like he was doing in his spare time. And that's when I first found out about it. I mean, we had a really weird email exchange, and I actually talked to some colleagues about it, trying to decide what to do about it. And you know, whenever you're writing a story, you're deciding, like, obviously writing about this wouldn't necessarily make him look great. So you talk about, you know, is this newsworthy? Should I write about this? And at the time, it, you know, there weren't a lot of listeners, it seemed like, anyway, had a pretty small following. So I just decided to sit and wait.
But the most bizarre interview was when he interviewed himself. Why don't you explain how this worked out and the tie-in back to genetically modified organisms?
I think that from an outsider looking in, that's something I was unsure about, because this appeared at the time to just be a straight science communication podcast, despite what the intentions were. That's how it looked. And I think that anytime you have someone interviewing themselves and sort of making it look objective, that's a little questionable. It's what's the intention there? Or even if there isn't a bad intention, is this a good idea?
Especially when you're a plant scientist from the University of Florida.
Especially when you're a plant scientist, and especially this is a very heated topic. Maybe if I was talking about this with someone the other day, and they said maybe if you were a scientist studying trilobites or something like that, this wouldn't have been as questionable. But when you are, you know, communicating about something that's so polarizing, I think that it's perhaps wise to be very careful in how you're deciding to do that. And in these interviews, he was interviewing himself, not just about GMOs and the science there, but also specifically about Monsanto, and asking himself, do you have ties to Monsanto? And answering, no, I don't. So
and that's not true, right?
Well, it's complicated, but no, that's not true. So these FOIA requests, which, by the way, were put in place by this group, U.S. Right to Know, which is an activist group. They're really broad FOIA requests. I support FOIA. I'm a journalist. I think it's a really important tool, but they were incredibly broad requests. There's been a lot of controversy over whether they're abusing FOIA or whether, like, how appropriate this was. But regardless, they got approved. Florida especially has strong sunshine laws where it's quite easy to get this sort of access with broad FOIA requests. But anyway, they requested documents from him, emails between Folta and these different companies. And the whole time he had been saying, so when you communicate about GMOs, if you're saying anything that's neutral or remotely positive, inevitably someone on the internet is going to call you a shill, and usually a shill for Monsanto. It's a similar thing that happens when people write about vaccines, and you have people writing and saying, well, you must be a shill for Big Pharma because you know, whatever. It's a similar thing that happens. And when that would happen to him, at least according to, you know, the articles and Reddit AMAs and other very public conversations he was having, he would say, no, I have no ties to them. And specifically Monsanto. And these emails revealed that, and I want to be clear, there's no evidence that his science has been funded by Monsanto. There's no evidence of that. And that's been sort of spun to sort of suggest that that's the case. Not all of his emails have come out, and maybe that will change. But as of now, there's no real evidence to show that his science is suspect. And most of the research he does actually isn't something that a company like Monsanto would be interested in, because it wouldn't necessarily be something that's commercially viable for them. But anyway, it did come out that he had received a $25,000 grant through his university from Monsanto to help fund this public outreach program that he had been, you know, doing for a very long time. You know, this is the kind of stuff that people had been wanting to know about, and he didn't see it as a tie that needed to be disclosed, and the public did. There was a big outcry over this. So that was originally reported in the journal Nature. And then the New York Times ran a big story both about Folta and about another scientist named Charles Benbrook, who has been largely funded from the organic industry. And they also did a FOIA request. I think the New York Times did this, although I'm not sure, on that guy's emails. And they had this really big piece just outlining some of the interactions these scientists were having with these different industry groups and suggesting that industry was enlisting them in this very intense battle over this technology.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to journalist Brooke Burrell. So what can listeners, what should they take away from an episode like Kevin Folta? Is this a harmless scientist who just decided to wade into some prickly waters with GMOs, or is there more there?
I think that what this story, at least what I found from it, is that it's really hard for these scientists to navigate this sort of gray area between industry and academia and agriculture research. I do think he did something that was really inappropriate, however he intended it. And I think that it points to these issues of conflict of interest that need to be looked into. But there isn't evidence that Monsanto has been funding his research, and there's not evidence of some big some conspiracy. Still, I think that this highlights the sort of gray area that these scientists are navigating. And I think that there should be clearer rules and more disclosure and more transparency in these interactions that they're having.
So the term GMO, genetically modified organism, is not as black and white as some think it is. Where do you stand on efforts to require food labels to let consumers know if products have GMOs in them or not?
My views of labeling have changed over time. Most scientists that I interview are against it because it just doesn't make sense from a science perspective. It's a process, not an ingredient. So there aren't that many labels out there that do talk about process necessarily, like a breeding technique.
Brooke Burrell is a journalist. People can go to Brooke Burrell, that's BROOKEBOREL.com, to check out more of her work. And her latest book is Infested. It's a book on bed bugs. Brooke, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to talk to you. I won't do you no harm. I just want to know about your different lives on this here people farm. I hear some of you have families living in cages, tall and cold. Some just sit there and dust away past the age of old. But is this true?
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Brent Constance. He's the founder of Blue Planet. Brent, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be here.
So Blue Planet is a new way of looking at concrete. Why do we need to look at concrete in a new way, though?
Concrete is the most traded material other than water in the whole world. So any venue you go anywhere in the world today, almost, Concrete is the principal construction material. It makes up more than half the building materials of all buildings. And as you know, buildings themselves are the largest user of power, as well as the largest carbon footprint and embodied energy that we have. So when we look at buildings, for example, mostly over the last few decades, we've looked primarily at their efficiency, meaning cooling, heating, lighting, etc. But now that we're becoming much more efficient, the actual embodied energy in any building or road, anything we construct, is turning out to be the largest carbon footprint of anything we build, and not its operating history. In fact, there's a movement, Architecture 2030, to bring all buildings to zero net energy by 2030, which we're making great progress on. But at that time, we'll still have the embodied energy of all the materials used to build the building. And it turns out with concrete, which is the principal building material in most buildings, that's where the largest carbon footprint is. It's not in the carpet fibers or anything else. It's in the concrete.
And people would be surprised to hear that, I think. What goes into the concrete process that is so carbon intensive?
Well, about 10 or 15% of the mass of a yard of concrete is Portland cement, which is the binder that binds together all the sand and gravel in the cement. And the way you make Portland cement is you locate a cement plant near a limestone quarry, you quarry the limestone, and then you burn coal or some other fossil fuel, usually, to heat the limestone or calcine it up to very high temperatures. And what happens at that temperature is for every ton of Portland cement you make, you put off about a ton of carbon dioxide. So the reason that's significant is there's over 15 billion tons of concrete poured every year worldwide, and there's almost 4 billion tons of Portland cement used in that concrete. Furthermore, the sand and gravel put in the concrete is often transported great distances in order to get it to the ready-mix plant where the concrete is formulated.
And it's obviously very heavy, and that takes carbon as well to transport.
Correct. For example, here in Northern California, a lot of our aggregate, we call it, comes from British Columbia on barges. And understandably, from an environmental perspective, it's harder and harder to permit rock quarries, because rock quarries are what takes mountaintops off. Almost all quarrying of rock is open pit. And remarkably, there's over 35 billion tons of rock mined for the purpose of aggregate every year worldwide. And just to put that in perspective, there's about 5 billion tons of coal mined. And most coal is mined in shafts. So, but we focus primarily on coal mining, but it's actually really rock mining that's destroying the environment. And so there's both a need to address the mining of rock, as well as address the carbon footprint that's coming from Portland cement, which is the cementing component of the concrete.
So Blue Planet, what is the big idea behind it?
Well, with Blue Planet, not only are we making the constituents of concrete, other than by forming Portland cement through mining limestone and burning it, or aggregate through mining it in open pit quarries, but our fundamental raw material for all our materials is carbon dioxide. From many perspectives, Blue Planet is viewed as a carbon capture company. That is, a company with the ability to go out and capture carbon dioxide. But we're not capturing it from the atmosphere, for example. We're capturing it at large point source emitters of carbon dioxide, meaning coal-fired power plants, natural gas-fired power plants, cement plants, and other industrial plants, like ethanol refineries, for example. These are places where most of the carbon dioxide, all the anthropogenic carbon dioxide, is coming from. The other half is coming largely from transportation. So we call these point source emitters, places where you can go and capture large amounts of carbon dioxide. And just to put that in perspective, we believe humans are putting about 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere every year. And about half of that is coming from these point source emitters. And the largest single one is coal-fired power plants. And now China is the largest emitter of any of the countries in the world. And so it's really the coal-fired power plants in China that are the number one producer of carbon dioxide in the whole world. But there are also natural gas plants and cement plants, as I mentioned. To make our materials, we require large quantities of carbon dioxide. In fact, for every ton of carbon dioxide we take in, we make a little more than a ton of our material. There's a need to actually capture carbon dioxide actively. That is, we've made enormous strides in energy efficiency, for example. And, you know, as Steve Chu said, the former Secretary of Energy, that's where our biggest strides are going to be. And we've done a really pretty good job over the last few decades in, you know, everything from lighting to air conditioning to heating to insulation. There's been enormous strides in improving the energy efficiency of buildings. We've also made enormous strides in changing from fossil energy to renewable energy and wind and solar in particular. But there's other renewables like tidal current generation that are being looked at. Even the cold of the ocean is being used to augment air conditioning, which is a large part of the amount of electricity used. And there have been strides with the short-lived climate pollutants as well, incredible strides. I think there's over 80 short-lived climate pollutants that have been significantly mitigated. And China has even signed up on the Montreal Protocol for that now. But even with all of that, if we do not actively capture the carbon dioxide coming from fossil fuel power generation and cement plants, we still lose the battle. We cross the 2-degree change and everything begins to change. So, in fact, if we were to do none of the other great advances that I just mentioned, but only tackle coal-fired power plants and be able to tackle the carbon emissions from the coal-fired power plants, we would be okay. But if we do all those other things that we've been doing so well and we don't address coal-fired power plants, we won't be okay. We lose the battle. And that's been shown over and over again by many different climate scientists. So it's recognized we absolutely have to capture carbon dioxide. And this is driving the recent EPA regulation 111D, which is coming through, which will require all the states to come up with their own plan to mitigate carbon dioxide and regulate it as a pollutant, similar to what California is attempting to do right now. What Blue Planet is doing is we have the ability to go out to a large carbon emitter, capture the carbon dioxide, and turn it into carbonate minerals, which are the constituents of limestone, which get used in concrete, sequestering the carbon dioxide in the concrete. And that has a couple of effects. First of all, it sequesters the carbon dioxide in the concrete that would have gone into the atmosphere, which is a huge plus. So you can take a large coal-fired plant that may be putting 10 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every year and mitigate that 10 million tons. But the other effect it has, to the extent that it's replacing the aggregate and the cement and the concrete, it's offsetting the need for that aggregate being transported in from British Columbia or wherever, you know, long distances. And if it's replacing cement or lowering the amount of cement needed, it's also lowering the carbon footprint of the concrete that would have come from the cement. So it has a twofold benefit. And of course, we all wish coal would just go away, and we all wish fossil fuel would just go away. It's not a renewable resource. But we also have to be realistic that that's where half of all the power is coming from now. And even if we go renewable as fast as we possibly can, it's still going to be a significant part of our power. And in China and India, where the real problem is, it'll be their main source of power for many decades to come. And if we don't do something proactively, we will lose the battle.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to geologist and entrepreneur Brent Constance. So when you mention carbon capture, many listeners immediately think, well, that's like carbon capture sequestration or CCS, which most people believe is not a realistic solution to address our coal usage. Your technology is obviously quite different, but do you share their skepticism regarding CCS?
Yeah. Well, even if it were technically feasible, you know, and that's a whole area where there are a lot of experts which disagree on a number of things. But even if it were technically feasible, it's just not economically feasible. And, you know, the whole idea that we're going to capture all of the pollutants, you know, comes from the earliest theories of environmental law that a polluter will pay and all of this. And when you look at how the Clean Air Act handled sulfur dioxide in the Northeast, for example, it's a huge success. And the Clean Air Act worked perfectly there. The problem with CO2 is there's so much of it. You know, the levels of sulfur dioxide and flue gas is sort of in the couple thousand parts per million range, right? For the amount of CO2 in flue gas, it's sort of the 100 to 150,000 parts per million, you know. So it's not even comparable. And the idea that you're going to tax it or, you know, regulate it by that mechanism, just it won't pencil out. For example, if the Chinese want $100 a ton from the West to mitigate their CO2, and we need them to mitigate 10 billion tons, it's $1 trillion a year. You know, there isn't money to do that. But if they're turning into concrete, which they're using and buying anyway, and it's actually not even a strain on them, it's actually a profit center, everything changes. And it has to be something that can be commercialized today, which we can do with concrete. And it has to be something that can be implemented today, you know, which we can with Blue Planet's technology. What's remarkable about what Blue Planet's doing is also that even though we've invented these processes, we're using constituents that are available commercially at scale from many vendors today that are assembled. So we don't have some new manufacturing process for some critical new technology that's going to take years of development.
He's a geologist and the founder of Blue Planet, Brent Constance. Brent, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It was great being here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Potato Valdez, Ricky Lee Jones, and John Coltrane. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.